Broadcasting out of Seattle, Washington, this is West Coast Radio. Very good to be with you after a little bit of a break. Sorry about that. I've been living life, you know, doing things. And today's guest on the program is somebody I'm really excited about introducing you to. He is somebody that I've known about even before we set this interview up. I knew about him for a long time because, as you know, I have a passion for paddleboarding. And Carl Krueger is probably the best paddleboarder out there. If not the best, one of the best. He is exceptional. He is an adventurer, first and foremost. He could be summed up as a guy that lives his life one grand adventure, outdoor adventure, after another. So he's a mountain climber. He's been doing that since 3 years old. He taught himself how to windsurf at 12. He's a surfer, cross-country skier, excellent sailor, and again, like I said, a second-to-none paddleboarder. He's the only person, in fact, to ever complete the Race to Alaska 750-mile water race from Port Townsend to Ketchikan, Alaska, on a paddleboard. So he's really an exceptional person. I've really enjoyed hearing about his story, and I'm really glad to share his story with you. Of course, all information as to where you can find out about Carl Krueger, his website, social media, all of that is in the episode's description and social media post regarding this episode. But I'll tell you right now, you can go to carlkrugerofficial.com, and that is his website. He's an interesting dude. So let's get into it. I won't take up any more of your time with this introduction. He is a true ocean man, a true water man, Carl Krueger. So what introduced you to this life of adventure? Were you born that way, or were you nurtured into that by your parents?
There was no escape, really. Yeah, I mean, my parents were a little different, to put it mildly. My mom, she's from Norway, and, in that tradition, the kids learn how to ski before they could even walk, and so she did the same with me. She had me on little cross-country skis between her knees. I don't even remember it, so I've been on skis since I can remember it. And my dad, he was half Algonquin and, grew up in the paddling tradition. There's a huge generation gap between, for him. I mean, he was 64 when I was born. And so he was born in 1909 and grew up in the paddling culture in upstate New York, very strong paddling culture. And so he started me in paddling, and he was a climber too. And so, we ran around the Adirondack Mountains in upstate New York. And so, there was just no escape, my mom used to like to tell the story about, my dad. I was just a few days old after I was born, and my dad wanted to quote unquote imprint me with all the sights and smells and sounds of the woods, and they went straight out into the woods and spent a couple of days out there just trotting me around and letting it soak in, and so both of them, put that into me for sure.
Yeah. It's really interesting because I always think if you're going to have kids, because the world can be very hard and very painful, very sad in many ways, but also, of course, very beautiful. And I think that it's my opinion. A lot of people have kids that maybe shouldn't, but that's just my opinion. It's whatever. And I think if you're going to have children, you should be able to, in some ways, lay out what is it about this world that I want to show them. And I think for your parents, just reading about you and reading about what you were exposed to from your first memory, I'm sure your parents, if somebody asked them that question right before you were born, they could list out a bunch of things about the world that they wanted to show you.
Totally. Well, I mean, what's funny about that is that, in cruising around in the woods, a lot of times, a poison will be just a few steps away from the cure, and my parents were no exception to that. It's a difficult thing to paint a picture of my parents. I mean, both of them were deep trauma survivors, like my dad, at the age I am now, I'm able to look back on all the wonderful things they're able to pass on to me, but they were both deeply challenged. I mean, they were probably in that category of people you were talking about who should not have had children. They I am so grateful that they were able to do those good things for me that they did, you know, because without that, you know, I probably would have ended up on the street with a drug habit. You know, I mean, it's, they gave me the cure right along with the poison. You know, it was, you know, later on in life when I started healing from the stuff that I had to go through as a child, you know, dealing with them and the losses I had and whatnot, which is a pretty sordid tale in and of itself. I ran straight to the mountains. I ran straight to the sea, you know, like that's where I, that's where I did my healing. You know, I mean, for as much as my father taught me, he was an absolute monster. You know, I mean, he was one of those kids that survived residential school, you know, so, just deep, deep trauma. You know, my mom survived the war in Germany. You know, she was just there to visit family and ended up being trapped there through the war and had her own demons, you know? And so the both of them were just psycho, you know, in a lot of ways, really. But there was this other side to them, you know, there was that part of them that was just infinitely human and compassionate and all of that. So like, again, you know, the poison was right two steps away from the salve to heal it, you know?
Yeah. So. Very interesting. You know, every now and again, I have my bouts with addiction myself. And because of that, I have a real interest in addiction and what an addict is and what they look like. And one thing I notice is that if somebody, it's on the recovery side, but once somebody recovers from being an addict, a lot of times they'll turn to a life of grand adventure because that kind of, it kind of curbs that enthusiasm for whatever they left behind. So it's interesting. Do you think you would have been an addict for real if you hadn't found this life?
No question about it in my mind. You know what I mean? I was telling somebody about it just a couple of days ago, actually. There was a time in my life, you know, I could paint you the whole sordid tale or whatever. I was definitely suicidal, you know, as a teenager, you know, like I just couldn't seem to figure out a reason why anybody would really even want to live this life. You know, I mean, it was just so dark. Like I was in such a dark place, you know, the losses I'd had, you know, I lost my brother, you know, my sister died in my arms, you know, it's like, there's a lot of things that went on, you know, in stuff in my dad's hands that is, you know, a lot of it's even just unspeakable, but like, I was in this really dark place, you know, and I remember just coming, I had this epiphany, you know, I was like, if I'm going down, it's not going to be because I'm puking on myself in the ditch. You know what I mean? I'm going to go climbing and climb as freaking hard as I possibly can. And I'm going to push myself. And if I fall off something, then it's great. You know, that's the way I want to go. Like I made this decision that like, I wasn't going to do it with a needle sticking out of my arm. I was going to do it, you know, reaching as hard as I could for something better. And what happened, you know, so I ran off to the mountains, you know, and I ran off to the sea and surfing and everything else. But it was the mountains where I really threw myself into stuff. And the craziest thing happened. Like I started loving my life, you know, like I had a reason to get up in the morning. Like I loved it, you know, I mean, just to get up and go out, you know, and I ended up working as a climbing guide and just to be out in the mountains all day and in that environment with people that are stoked, you know, and it turned my life around. It literally saved my life. If it wasn't for that decision, I probably would have died with a needle sticking out of my arm. I know people that did back then, grew up in upstate New York, you know, and it was not exactly a cheerful place to grow up, you know? And then, you know, so through my 20s and delivering yachts and stuff, like I just got lit, you know, I just got so excited about doing this stuff. And then to such a deep extent that like coming back into this life, you know, it's really hard because it feels flavorless, you know, like I've struggled most of my adult life with finding that kind of joy just in everyday life. And I'm getting there, you know, I mean, I'll be 50 this year and I'm getting to the point where like, you know, this isn't so bad. You know, like I used to go from one climbing project to the next, you know, it's just a couple of days between because I hated touching down, you know, I just want to go fly. But over the years, you know, the projects that I do have gotten bigger and the time between them has gotten longer, you know, necessarily because these things are expensive, you know, like this paddle in the Arctic is no joke. It's a lot of money. And so there's these long stretches between and I've had to learn how to navigate life and be happy here too, you know, and that's been a real challenge for me for sure.
So In your website, it says from your late teens to early 30s, you dove deep into a climbing frenzy that forever changed you. That's what you're talking about. What you were forever changed, that's a process of finding a meaning to this life.
Absolutely. Yeah. And beyond that, like diving into, you know, the real depths of who you are as a person, you know, like when you find yourself in these environments that could be lethal, you know, if you do something wrong, you know, I mean, I was climbing at a level that, you know, no fall zone, you know, is just like, don't fall because you're done. You know, I mean, there are multiple climbs I did with partners where if either one of us peeled, we'd both be dead, you know, and to go into those situations and dig deep into yourself like that, you know, gives you a, you know, you develop this inner strength that I don't think there are many ways to get to otherwise. You know what I mean? I think you have to, there aren't very many pathways to that. You know, I think that's a confidence and a self-discipline, and just a culling of all the rough bits. You know what I mean? Like you can't, you know, like my buddy Steve, who I used to climb with quite a bit, he used to say that, well, you got to have a pure heart to do this kind of stuff. You know, you can't go out there having a whole bunch of stuff to sort out, you know, because that becomes like an anchor around your neck. You know, you can't fly. I mean, you can't fly like that. You know, it's just too heavy emotionally and mentally. You know, you've really got to go and be light. And so that means you have to have done the homework, you know, and as these projects have gotten bigger, that, you know, that work has gotten deeper, you know, like this project paddling through the Arctic this summer, I mean, that's a depth and a breadth and a level of self-reflection and deep work that I've never experienced before.
And I definitely want to get into that in depth, but you know, as we talk about the addict in us, and you talk about you as a grand adventurer, one thing that I'm kind of, it's kind of popping up in my head, is this idea of chasing a dragon. And you know, you mentioned your projects are getting bigger and they're getting bolder. So it seems like you build a tolerance, just like you would to a drug. You build up a tolerance, and it seems like you may need more and more of a grand adventure as you continue through your life and your pursuits. Do you think eventually one of the adventures is going to get you, you know, as it continues to grow in skill level and danger, really? Do you feel like eventually you might get got by one of the adventures you're on?
Yeah, maybe. You know, it could happen. And that's okay. You know, I mean, I'd still rather that than, you know, become an old man and sitting in my rocking chair looking out the window and wish that I'd gone after it instead. You know, yeah. I mean, that's an outcome that I can't live with, you know? And so, you know, there's a book I read a number of years ago called Untethered Soul. And I can't suggest that book strongly enough to everybody. Like, you know, and it's not because there's anything in there that's even really all that earth shattering or groundbreaking or anything like that. But the author has put down so succinctly what it means to explore your edges, you know, and what a construct it is that there are edges at all, you know. And for me, the work that I'm doing, you know, and going after these larger projects is that, like, for me, true freedom is beyond those edges that we create for ourselves. You know, it's the one thing that's just untenable in my life that I'll never succumb to is living in fear. I just never will. You know, I'm never going to not do something because I'm afraid, you know, because that is a construct. That's a cage that we build for ourselves. And I feel this, you know, and lots of people do. Like, I'm not weird in this way. Like, you talk to people who can go after things like this, and each and every one of them will talk about the overwhelming sense of freedom and connectivity that you enjoy when you approach that edge and you just keep on going. And you just don't let any of those little lesser selves, those little voices that are like, well, there's all this other stuff you should be doing instead, you know, instead of chasing that passion that you're after. Once you get through that barrier, that is ultimate freedom. You are, it's a feeling that I can't even begin to describe, where you are, in a very real way, unstoppable emotionally and mentally. You know, you're tapped in. I mean, that there's a universal power there that there's no other way to get to. You know, it comes from within, you know.
You touched on it just a little bit, lightly. And I want to ask this question almost for me more than the audience, but I'm sure a lot of them will relate to it. A lot of my guests that I have on the show that really have an impact on me, a lot of them can relate to this as well. But, I recently graduated college within the last few years. And I think about this concept of the 9-to-5. You know, as somebody who truly wants to be free, when you think about the 9-to-5, it's a real mind fuck. And the reason for that is because it's a majority of your life that you're giving to something that most of us don't have a passion for. And I'm just wondering, how do you come to terms with that idea? How do you come to grips with the idea of a 9-to-5 and, you know, balancing, okay, I need money to pursue my passions, but at the same time, holy shit, this is a majority of my life that I may have to donate to something that I'm not passionate about. How do you come to terms with that as a true adventurer, as a true free spirit?
Yeah, that's a decision I made early on in my life. And actually, I had to come to terms with that just a handful of years ago. I was like, oh my God, you know, these thoughts I'm having, this realization that, you know, Jesus, I'm pushing 50, you know, oh my God, you know, like in a lot of ways, I never thought I'd live this long. You know, there's probably really good reasons why I shouldn't have. But here I am, you know, I'm pushing middle age, right? And I had this realization, and it hit me kind of hard. You know, I was like, you know, I'm not, there's no going back. You know, I can't, there's no going back in changing my mind about how I'm going to spend my life. You know, I promised myself, you know, when I was real young, you know, I mean, I left home when I was 15, and I promised myself that I was going to live my life outdoors, jamming and doing my thing. And that was vastly more alluring than the picket fence, the 9-to-5, big house, the 6 cars, the all that crap. You know, I mean, that to me equals total waste of my life. And because look at them, you know, I mean, I look at dudes my age now and I'm like, what in the hell happened to you, dude? You know, like, what happened to you, man? You look like crap. And that's what happens when you go that route, you know, and I could see it as a young guy. I mean, I looked at people and I was like, that's not how I want to be, you know, and there weren't a whole lot of role models for me growing up, you know, that way. But there were a few, you know, and I've gotten to meet a handful of them, you know, like climbers and sailors and stuff that have lived their life outdoors. And I'd way rather have stories to tell when I get old than a bank full of money, you know? And so to answer your question, like everything I've done in my adult life has been with a view towards what is the next thing. Like I need to work right now so I can make the money so I can do this next project and keep pushing those boundaries for myself. And, you know, my ex-wife and I started Kruger Escapes, a sailing charter business, about 15 years ago, you know, and that was a way to make some money and support, you know, that focus of being outdoors and help other people do the same, you know, and that's a win-win, you know, and it's not about making money because it's barely ever even broken even, but it is a way to support the habit and be outside and share those places with others. And that's something that has always been important to me, you know? And then for a while I had a construction company going out here on Orcas Island as well. And, you know, I had a few guys working with me and, but that also, you know, because I'm in management, I can work at night, you know, I can paddle during the day, work out with my trainer, Chuck, and you know, like I've engineered everything to give me maximum free time and flexibility so that if it's snowing, I can jam up to the mountain to go skiing if I have time. You know, I can go out to the coast if there's a swell coming. Everything I've done has been with an eye towards being able to break loose. I've just flatly refused to take a 9-to-5 where I don't have that kind of flexibility. I'm just not doing it.
I hear that. I want to talk about your athletic accomplishments in just one second, leading up to, of course, what you're about to embark on in July. But, you know, right now, I just, you know, I always ask people, especially people who spend a lot of time outdoors, any paranormal experiences? I'm talking Bigfoot, Yeti, mermaids, anything like that on your adventures?
You know, no. I mean, the answer is yes, but nothing like Bigfoot or anything like that. You know, I've never seen anything. Yeah. The answer is yes. But you know, nothing in the mountains. That's never happened. Nothing there. But I've always had a closer bond with the water. You know, I mean, I always have, and it took years for me to break off all the rough edges in the mountains and get worn down, get more. I always talk to people about how it's like being a smooth rock on the beach, you know, and that's what the mountains did for me. You know, they snapped off all the rough edges and wore me down smooth, you know, so that when I actually turned my focus to the water, I was a little bit more prepared. Surfing can do that too. Cause if you don't go out hard open and in tune, you get your ass handed to you. That's what happens, you know, and especially when the waves get bigger. And so that's why, you know, surfers tend to be deeper, you know, that at least the better ones. Anyway, you know, during my R2AK, that was the deepest experience I ever had, staying in flow state. You know, I'd never gunned it that hard for so long. And it was the deepest, my deepest experience, at least for in terms of duration, that I've ever had. And I started seeing stuff in the water on day three, you know, and I went through the checklist though. You know, I was like, I'm hydrated, I'm fed, I'm getting good sleep, you know, I was checking all the boxes. You know, it wasn't like I was depleted in any way. Like, this was just straight up connectivity. And I was feeling great. And it was only day three, you know? And anyway, I started seeing stuff in the water, you know? And that has persisted, to varying degrees ever since. And, you know, it started happening up around Campbell River. And then, you know, I had that with me all the way through Bella Bella and talked to a couple of people there about it. And, anyway, yeah, when I'm in deep flow state, I still see it, you know, like these pains of like, I mean, if you can imagine like a ray, like a manta ray, except silvery, it's like that, just ripping through the water underneath me, underneath the waves. I see them all the time when I'm in flow, not when I go out for like a casual day. I've got to be in flow for that to happen, but it does happen.
How interesting. Now, this was the race to Alaska, you said?
Race to Alaska. Yeah.
Incredible. You know, I don't know. Maybe you found the in-between, and once you're there, there's no going back. I don't know. I like to look at this. I don't know why, but I've always looked at this experience that we're in it's just like an onion. There's multiple layers to it. And, you know, Some people, when you're a little more open to it, when you really live life, you find a way in between the layers that most of us maybe never do. Very interesting.
That's a fact. Yeah. I would definitely concur. Yeah. I mean, there are multiple worlds. Yep.
All right. Tell me the story of the 7048, then we'll move on race to Alaska. And then we'll finish off with, of course, you know, the Northwest Passage paddle that you're going to embark on in July. So the 7048, what is the experience for people who don't know at home? I've talked about it before on the show, but you've got 70 miles to go in 48 hours. Starts basically in Tacoma, ends in Port Townsend. What is that experience like?
Yeah, so I mean, that's basically the Race to Alaska Light, and that's why the organizers came up with it, right? And the whole intent with that race, you know, it's put on by the Northwest Maritime Center, and you know, the whole intent was, you know, creating a race that people could get a taste of what it is to do the Race to Alaska, and they joined them at the hip, so that, you know, the 7048 race goes out and it finishes the day before the Race to Alaska goes out. And so it's, you know, if there's anything the Maritime Center is good at in Port Townsend is creating a media circus. And So having that, you know, the 7048 come in and then the Race to Alaska go right out again, it just really helps with that whole media thing. And it's more than that though. I mean, it's about community and getting people on the water. And you know, because every time these races happen, it feels like summer camp reunion to me. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, that the bonds that you form with people on the water and during these events are deep and lifelong, you know? And so when these events happen, you know, it's like, you're like, oh, hey dude, I haven't seen you since last year, you know? I mean, and it's like that every, you know, for days, you know, it's amazing. So the 7048, yes. So they send you out at night, you know, on the last of the ebb, out of Tacoma, and they give you 48 hours to cover the 70 miles to Port Townsend. And so they started that race. I don't know what year, well, I guess it was 2018 was the first time they ran it. 2017 was the year that I paddled the Race to Alaska. And, you know, still the only stand-up paddler to make it in Race to Alaska, and a few have tried. It's just a big nut, you know. I mean, you know, to paddle the Race to Alaska on a SUP, there's a lot to sort out, you know. I mean, it's totally doable, you know. Obviously I did it, but there's a lot to figure out to get it right so that you can do it safely and quickly. And anyway, so yeah, I paddled the Race to Alaska in 2017, and then in 2018 the 7048 started. And I've won the SUP class in the 7048 all three times that they've had that race. And I always paddle. I've got a different take on that. And I had a board built from the things I learned during the Race to Alaska, you know, and having that deeper dive into connectivity and what paddling even is, you know. So I had some design ideas for a race board for 7048, and I went back to Joe Bark and we designed Raven. And she's a very demanding board. She demands a very high cadence, and you know that blade's got to be in the water. It's a different. She demands flow state is what she demands. You know, there's no stability really. I mean, her inherent stability is very twitchy, blade's got to be in, you got to pull. And so we designed Raven because I wanted to push a little harder. You know, I wanted to see what it would be to paddle a board that demands that much of you for 70 miles. And so I paddle that board every time I've done 7048. And I always paddle nonstop and carry just enough Hammer nutrition stuff and water to fuel myself for the, you know, 12 or 13 hours that it takes me to do the 70 miles. I think the longest it's taken me is 16. And then I can't remember anyway, but it's in the teens anyway, 16 and 14 and 13 hours, I think, respectively.
From what I remember on YouTube, you did not do the wetsuit, right?
For 7048?
I don't remember if it was Race to Alaska or the 7048. Were you using a wetsuit? Because it's, you know, if you fall in, there's real consequences if you're not.
Yeah, it's called... For 7048, depends on the conditions, you know. I just kind of feel that out as I go along. For that, what I've been using is, you know, if it at night, it gets pretty chilly during 7048, you know, it's early June, it can be pretty chilly. And I've been using just a pair of tights, you know, at start, and then like, you know, just like a light top with a windbreaker, you know, later on. And then if I start getting cold, I've got this like perforated neoprene, and it just depends on what's happening, you know, and the real windy times I put the windbreaker on over the neoprene. But if I'm warm enough, I just stick to the pair of three-quarter tights and a light top and just paddle. And that's part of it. You know, I mean, as long as you're paddling, you're probably not going to get cold, but if you fall in, you know, and get wet, then you might, you know, and so far I haven't fallen in a single time, in 7048, except for the last time, actually I fell in right at the finish. I was wicked tired and I was coming in and, one of the committee boats came along behind me and waked me and I didn't see it coming and it knocked me right in right at the finish. It totally pissed me off. But I haven't fallen in on course yet, on any of those. And then the Race to Alaska too, I didn't fall in that whole time. And for a race to Alaska, I had a wetsuit with me. And there was one day where, you know, I was in this gale, in Johnstone Strait, and I had it on up to my waist because I felt like it was probable that I would fall in that day because it was pretty rowdy. But I never did, you know? So anyway, but I had it on up to my waist thinking that like, well, if I fell in and got cold, I could pull it on the rest of the way. And I just had a light top on, but it turns out I never needed it. And I was smoking hot all day long. It was way too hot with that thing on.
Interesting. So for the regular athlete, you know, you're far and above that. For the regular athlete in regards to the 70-48, this is it's a real goal of mine someday to be able to accomplish that. Can you just hug the shore the whole way? And it'll be pretty easy to, at least from a navigational perspective, to make it to Port Townsend?
Totally. Yeah, okay. Totally. I mean, there's a couple of spots where like to save yourself some miles, it'd be great if you could, you know, swing wide and just connect the dots and not follow the shore, you know, but navigationally it's really straightforward, you know, but there's some stuff you got to know. I mean, there's, you know, you need to be real comfortable with your VHF use and, you know, like some kind of handheld GPS so that you know exactly where you're at. And, you know, cause I can't remember the name of the passage, but just south of Bainbridge, you know, there's some commercial traffic in there at that time of day or night that people tend to go through there, and ferry traffic. And so you've got to be real savvy to staying out of their way, not getting run over. Cause by the time you get there, it's dark, right? So they can't see you. And so you've got to be able to communicate with them by VHF and, or just stay out of their way completely. So you don't even have to call them by the radio. But once you get past Bainbridge, you know, obviously there's the ferry going into Bainbridge, you know, but if you just time it, you know, if there's a ferry, you just wait till they go by and then paddle through there real quick. And the same thing for the Edmonds Kingston. You know, and then you round Point No Point and there's a crossing to get to the cut over to Port Townsend. But the navigation is pretty straightforward, you know, but you do want to be ready for, you know, fog that happened one year, on that crossing from Point No Point over to the cut. It was real foggy. And so that got a little weird navigating through there, but as long as you've got a GPS or a compass and both actually you should have, and your VHF, should be good to go. Yeah. Cause you're well outside the shipping lanes, you know, at that point. And, yeah, it's pretty straightforward navigation. I think anyone can do it. And actually, my girlfriend, Erica, she's teaching clinics, for people who are interested in doing it. And, she's, you know, helping people with those navigation things and whatnot. She's got one in a couple weeks.
You know, it's interesting because, I do a lot of my paddle boarding off of Sunnyside Beach in Steilacoom, and, It's a nice little beach. And, if you mention the 70-48, you're going to hear a lot of people, Oh, I have something to say about that. Oh, I did it this way. I did it that way. But not just that, I was in Hawaii once. And it's to give you an idea of how well known it is. You know, you can be in Waikiki Beach, and if you're telling somebody about it, there's always going to be somebody who knows. Yeah, it's becoming a legendary thing. Not quite like the Boston Marathon, but almost like the Boston Marathon. And
Cool.
Yeah. And before we talk about the race to Alaska and then finish up the interview here, when you say you have to be in a flow state for the board that you were on, how were you getting nutrition in and how are you hydrating if you always have to have a paddle in the water because, you know, it's kind of an unstable board?
Yeah, totally. So, one of my sponsors is Hammer Nutrition. And, so I use their products, you know, all the time. And, so there's a product called Heed that I put in my water, and that's electrolyte replacement, which is super important for long races like that. And I mix a pretty heavy batch too, so that there's plenty of electrolytes going back in. Cause that's where cramping comes from and all that. And then they've got, a ton of different products, but the ones I really like, for that race, you know, cause the whole thing is like your body's not used to having meals in the middle of the night, you know? And so, you know, bringing bologna sandwiches or whatever is not a good idea. And plus it's, you know, for me, it makes me feel sick if I'm paddling that hard and I eat food like that. So I don't bring any of that kind of food at all. And I use, a product of theirs called Perpetuum Solids. And it's like a same idea as like a power gel, you know, and then basically what's going on is, you know, your body depending on your age, your BMI, your fitness, and all of that, you can only absorb a certain number of calories per hour, or whatever time frame you want to look at. You can only absorb a certain amount of calories while you're at output level like that. So it really does, you know, and the rest just go, they just go straight through. So there's really no good at all in eating food if you're paddling or running or whatever it is you're doing, because you're just wasting it, you know. And it, actually what you're doing is, you know, you're forcing out your blood to go to your stomach and try to digest that, when what it should be doing is delivering oxygen and nutrients to the rest of your body. So eating is a bad idea. And so, you know, I use these Perpetuum solids, and it's just maintenance calories, just enough to keep the lights on. And there's lactic acid buffering and ammonia buffering and micronutrients to help you with, you know, cramping and those sorts of things. And that's all I eat all night. And then I bring gels for if I feel like there's a bonk coming on, which I've never had, that, you know, I bring them just in case. Or if you feel like you're going to hit the wall, you just take on a few extra calories with some gels or something. And that's basically all I bring. Yeah.
So the race to Alaska, just to give the audience an idea, it's a 750-mile race, and it's frigid waters. You know, we're going from, like we said, Port Townsend to Ketchikan, Alaska. You're the first person ever to accomplish this on a stand-up paddleboard. And yeah, just tell me, what was the hardest part? And yeah, what was the most difficult part? I can't imagine 750 miles. It took you like 19 days or something, right?
Yeah, 14 on the dot, actually.
Okay.
14 days on the dot. Yeah. 2 weeks, which miraculously was the number I was kind of guessing at in the beginning, like when people were asking me how long it would take, and that was my guess. My goal was 60 miles a day, but I only, you know, to average, but I only was able to average about 50 just because of conditions and, you know, just how I was feeling and, you know, my body and everything. So 50 was the number I hit. But the hardest part of these types of projects for me is always getting off the beach the first time, you know, like once I'm underway, I'm good to go. But there's just like that input activation energy that it takes to jump on the board and start doing it. You know what I mean? And the deeper in I go, the easier it becomes. So for me, it's always the right up front, you know, like here I go, you know, getting on the board and, you know, off we go. So yeah, that's always been the hardest thing for me. But once I was underway, like it was just this steady, happy flow every day. You know, I mean, it's work, you know, I mean, I'll never say it wasn't hard, because it really was. But I was happy, you know, I mean, I love the rhythm of paddling those miles. You know, my goal was, you know, at least 50, and then I'd start looking for a campsite, and finding water and refilling my water and just taking care of business and putting up my tent and, you know, just, but the daily flow of that is just absolutely wonderful. You know, it's a really good place to be. And at least for me, you know, and I have no issues with being alone. Just super happy just to be alone with my thoughts and in nature and seeing all the wildlife and putting that blade in the water. Absolute heaven. So the average I did every day was about 50 miles. And then the longest day I had was about 72 when I had to cross Queen Charlotte Sound, or Strait, I should say Queen Charlotte Strait, from Vancouver Island around Cape Caution. There was a weather system coming in that I had to beat. So I had to make that paddle happen in one day. And so that was the longest day I had. But yeah, it was really good. And I learned a whole lot. You know, about myself and about, you know, just a lot of things. You know, my paddle stroke went through a sea change, completely changed my paddle stroke. I learned a lot about, you know, what I want from a board. I mean, it's just, you know, just all kinds of little things I learned, you know, about my gear and just learning that navigation tricks and that. It was a amazing experience.
I ask this to everybody who accomplishes grand things, who goes on grand adventures and completes the adventure. And I was kind of turned on to the idea. This is a very minuscule adventure comparatively, but I ran my first marathon because I thought it would make me happy. You know, a marathon is, you look at the numbers, less than 1% of people will ever complete a marathon. And I thought, wow, okay, that's a rare accomplishment. And because of that rare accomplishment, I'll be distinguished and it'll make me happy, you know, that accomplishment. So I trained for it really hard and I worked for it, put one foot in front of the other, and I finished it. And it was really maybe a little emotional, but it was like, holy shit, I did it. And that lasted for about 6 hours. And then I was like, okay, now what? it wasn't a sustainable form of happiness, the what I considered a grand accomplishment at the time. And what I learned in that later down the line is, of course not. It's the event, it's, you know, getting there and, you know, all the training and the friends you meet along the way and what you learn about yourself, what you can do. That's the stuff that makes it worth it, not necessarily the accomplishment in and of itself, because that's very fleeting. But what I want to ask you is, you know, because what you did in my eyes is way bigger of a deal than what I did. How long after you accomplish something so grand does the happiness stick around before you either go, shit, you know, what am I going to do next?
Well, it's weird, you know. I mean, that's a complex question in a way. And I don't know how much of this to attribute to my own wiring or what, you know, really. But I wasn't even done yet when I started thinking about the Northwest Passage paddle. You know, I hadn't even gotten to Ketchikan yet. And I knew it was the day that I was crossing Dixon Entrance. And that night I did about 55 miles across Dixon Entrance, you know, big open water crossing, you know, you're wide open to the Pacific, and it was a rowdy day. But if that was the day that I crossed into Alaska, and I was basically there, you know, like all the big hurdles were done and all I had was one more day of paddling, and I was in. So I knew I was going to make it, you know, and I was out there in Dixon Entrance, and I just started thinking like, okay, well, this has been amazing. You know, this is freaking amazing. It was one of the best experiences of my life, and where can I go in the world and have this for longer? You know, like, how could I do this for longer and deeper? You know, like, what's the next step from this? Where, you know, because it's even while I was paddling the R2AK, it started feeling like a proof of concept for something larger. Like, I had that notion, you know, the whole time. I was like, well, this is working, you know, and it's really not that hard, you know. And I was kind of, you know, you go into these things and you kind of, at least I do, and I hope that there's something that'll come along that'll like truly test me, you know, and that never came, you know. And so there's a little bit of disappointment in that, you know, in that it was mentally relatively easy, you know. I never had trepidation in the morning getting back on the board and setting off and doing some paddling that day. I never thought about quitting. That just never happened, you know. And that, again, that is not to say that it was easy, because it was not, you know. I mean, there was lots of pain. There was lots of pain. There was lots of discomfort. There was lots of shitty things that happened, but I was jamming along and happy in general, you know, like that like bad memory of, you know, it was one of the best quotes ever. Somebody asked, I think it was John Long. He's a alpine climber, you know, somebody asked him, you know, what it takes to be a good alpine climber. And he said, a bad memory, you know. But that was one of the things that was different about the idea to go to the Northwest Passage, is that I was still in the shit when the notion came to me for the next paddle. You know, I was out there in Dixon Entrance getting my ass handed to me with one squall after another, and spent half the day on my knees, you know, bracing against wind and waves and stuff. And I was in the middle of that when the idea for the next one came up, you know. And so it wasn't even a bad memory thing. It was more like a, I didn't want to be done thing. You know, it was more like, I feel more alive when I'm doing that stuff than I do when I'm back here, working for money or whatever I do here. You know, I mean, I didn't want to be done, you know. I mean, that very night when I got across Dixon and got into Alaska, and I was camping on this point, I was super bummed, you know. Like, I was proud of myself, I guess, you know, and I was like, hey, you know, it worked, and holy shit, you know, stand up paddling, we just bumped the bar up a little bit higher. that's cool. You know, I was feeling good about all that, of course, but I was bummed too. You know, I didn't want to be done. And like, and so the next day, you know, I got up and I got back on the board and started paddling. You know, I got it done, but it was bittersweet. You know, I didn't want to be done.
What a trip. Damn. And I think a lot of people, if you don't go on grand adventures, you won't understand that. But yeah, it's something that I can't even really respond to. It's just something to think about. You seem like a very humble guy. You'll never call yourself an extraordinary person, but I really think that's a characteristic of an extraordinary person. Every now and again, I have the pleasure of talking to somebody who is, and that mindset is wonderful to me. It really is wonderful to me. Anyway, what do you think about, or tell the audience about the Northwest Passage Paddle that's coming up in July. I'm not too familiar with the Northwest Passage Paddle myself, so I'm really interested to hear it. And you also said there are some geopolitical, social, and environmental topics that surround this paddle. So tell me all about it. Tell the audience about it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so basically what happened is, you know, there I was paddling the race to Alaska, and I got thinking about what the next logical step would be from that, you know, and where do I go from here? You know, I can go farther. I know this. And you know, where can I go in the world that I'm, you know, that's committing, that's demanding, that's beautiful, that's north, you know, like I've always been drawn to cold north places, you know, and, you know, in my climbing past, and that has always been about sparsity and being out in the air, you know, and exposure. I enjoy exposure a whole lot. And anyway, the idea came up, and I have to admit, you know, I mean, it came up just purely selfishly, like, wow, you know, the Northwest Passage, you know, it's a place that I've always wanted to go. I always sort of assumed I would sail through there. But the notion came to me of paddling it instead, you know, and doing it in that raw and unfiltered and very pure and very hands-on way. Just the same as the race to Alaska. I mean, that was my favorite part of doing the race to Alaska that way, is because there's really nothing in the way. I mean, it was a purely unfiltered experience. You know, you're just out in it, you know, like there's no escape, you know, there you are. And so anyway, so the notion of doing the Northwest Passage paddle came into my mind. And, you know, I was up there a couple of years ago, and when I left here, I was thinking that I was going to do the paddle, but, you know, in getting up there, I realized I wasn't ready yet. And for a whole bunch of reasons, I just was not the person I needed to be yet. And like,
what
you
is
said
the early, race really quickly? What is, does the race consist of, mileage wise and all of that?
Oh, it's not even a race. This is purely a solo effort. This is just me getting in the water and tuk to yak tuk. In the Northwest Territories in Canada, and paddling through a series of waterways that, you know, most of the year is frozen solid, because it, you know, it's well above the Arctic Circle. And, you know, those waterways extend eastward, you know, east-west running mostly. And I'm going to end up in Pond Inlet on Baffin Island, and it's about 2,000 miles all told. And there's a number of, you know, Inuit villages along the way that I'll be stopping at and resupplying. And so, you know, it's a totally different game this time. You know, it's a race in that you only have a couple of months of open water to paddle because you have to wait for the ice to melt in order for there to be enough water to even paddle. In terms of wide open exposure and raw nature 360, it's probably one of the wildest stretches of waterways on the planet.
Holy shit. Wow. So what are the geopolitical, social, and environmental topics surrounding this paddle? You know, it seemed like something more than just a paddle to you.
It's way more than just a paddle. And that's such a complex nut to even crack. You know, on the face of it, you know, I mean, you know, in a very blatant way, you know, these paddles for me are about accessing those primal instincts that humans have to connect with nature. That's what it's about for me. you know, when you think about it, you know, so one of the first interviews I did after Race to Alaska was with an author back East who had written a book, you know, Born to Walk, you know, and so he was writing all about walking and, you know, and just the magic that can happen just in the simple act of walking. Right. It was a pretty amazing book. And he's working on a book called Born to Paddle. And in our first conversation, he's a dear friend now, we got to be really good friends after that interview. And anyway, he was writing this book, Born to Paddle. And in that first interview, you know, he made a comment. I can't remember exactly how he said it, but it was something along the lines of, you know, well, of course we walked first and then we paddled, you know? And I was like, dude, if you buy into evolution at all, which you should, because, you know, science is a thing, for all your listeners out there, you know, evolution is definitely how we got here. We came crawling out of the ooze, you know, as water creatures long before we walked. So in terms of primal connectivity with the water, that came first, you know, that's how we got around, you know? And so, you know, and then later as humans and that, you know, we've been paddling for millennia, you know, and moving things around long before we had sailboats and steamships and things. So, it's a very old and very tactile and very baked in skill that humans have. And, anyway, so that's deeply important to me. You know, and there's definitely some baked in goodness having the Algonquin blood flowing through my veins. That helps a lot. So there's that, you know, and, you know, the most interesting people to me are those who enjoy a daily connectivity like that. And so, you know, my visits with Indigenous communities where there is still people who go out and get their own food. You know, that is amazing to me. And I love it. You know, I grew up hunting with my dad and fishing, and, you know, we had a garden too and everything, but I loved hunting as a kid, like absolutely loved it. And, you know, to be up there and talk and meet with some of those hunters and talk about polar bear hunting and talk about, you know, you don't, like I always say this, you know, like there's no vegetarians in Tuktoyaktuk. Arctic. You don't grow veggies in the Arctic. You know what I mean? Like, you walk around that town and it's all bones and blood and fur. And, you know, it's about hunting, you know, it's about going out and taking care of yourself and feeding your family. And, so there's that, you know, and then there's this tension though, because a lot of the Inuit, you know, communities up there would very much like to join the world economy. You know, the road to Tuktoyaktuk was built for oil and gas exploration. So you've got these, so you've got this one village, you know, that my jumping off point that has a road to it, so that oil and gas exploration can happen, so that they can join the world economy, so that they can then keep this climate change machine going that we've built that will further remove them from their heritage, right? So what's happening in the Arctic, like we're losing ice in the Arctic at a frantic rate. I mean, it is changing. So it's changing more rapidly in the Arctic at the poles, you know, both Arctic and Antarctica. It's changing faster there than anywhere else on the planet. And it's freakish how fast it's going, right? And so you've got these people who enjoy this connectivity with place, with the land, you know, I mean, that's how they talk about it, the land, you know, and it's beautiful to watch, right? But there they are clamoring to join this world economy and keep putting CO2 in the air, just like everybody else, you know? And so there's this tension there, right? So that's going on. And then you've got the fact that Canada claimed sovereignty over those waters, but hasn't yet enforce that, you know. So we've got Chinese icebreakers. They've got a number of icebreakers. You know, Russia's got something like 50 of them, and they're gunning to run freighters through the Northwest Passage, which are, you know, Canadian waters, right? And so you've got that political tension. And then on top of that, you've got, you know, current events today. You know, we've got Russia, you know, invading the Ukraine and everything. And they're posturing in the Arctic, and so is the United States right now. Actually, I read an article just a couple of days ago in the Times, New York Times, about how the U.S. is moving thousands of troops to Alaska to train in response to the fact that Russia is posturing in the Arctic, and they've been, you know, running exercises you know, all along the border with Alaska, and actually intimidating U.S. fishing boats that are inside of Canadian or inside of U.S. waters, you know. And so there's this, you know, geopolitical powder keg going on up there, you know, where Canada, you know, is the sovereign nation of these waterways I'm going to paddle this summer, but hasn't yet actually stepped up to the plate and enforced that, you know. And then you've got China and Russia looking to run goods through the Northwest Passage because it's a much shorter route than going down and around or through the ditch, you know, the Panama Canal. So it's just this deeply multi-layered project that is, it, you know, we're looking in the rearview mirror and, you know, and looking at human connectivity with place and the land and our heritage of feeding ourselves from this planet. And then we've got these larger geopolitical problems that are looking to change that place irrevocably. And so I think that my window for paddling through there and documenting and witnessing what is right now, I mean, it's already changed a whole lot, you know. I mean, it's nothing like it was in the Franklin days when they went through up there. And, you know, I don't want to have any of your listeners, you know, thinking that, you know, it's the, you know, the, it's all igloos and dog sleds and whatever, you know. I mean, it's, they're just like you and I, you know what I mean? They just, they live where they live, and, you know, their lifestyle is a little different, but they're just people, you know, and they watch TV just like everybody else, you know. It's, you know, not romanticizing their lifestyle. It is different, you know, but what I'm most attracted to in visiting those communities is just witnessing what's left of human connectivity with nature.
Do you have any plans for defending yourself against polar bears?
I do. Yeah. I will be carrying a 12 gauge shotgun, mostly as a noisemaker. You know, it's not about actually trying to kill one because I don't want to. It's more about making a bunch of noise. And if I have to bounce a slug off his head and, you know, scare him off, then I will. But it's more about just making noise, you know. And I, when I was up there, I talked with a bunch of hunters and, you know, all the people that I talked to up there, you know, I talked to the mayor of Tuck and a whole bunch of different people. And basically the consensus is, as long as you're not hunting them, you're probably going to be just fine. Cause they know the difference between someone who's just passing through, you know. And the hunters all said, like, just don't be an easy lunch, you know, just make it difficult, you know, fight back, make noises, you know, make sure they know they're there, you know, and don't let them get away with anything. They all let me know that it's basically like how you conduct yourself. Like, just don't be a victim. You know, it's like walking down a dark street in New York City, you know what I mean? Like, you just don't be a victim, you know, and, take care of shit and you'll be fine.
All right. Well, I've really enjoyed speaking with you. I want to leave you the floor to say anything left, if there anything you want to say to the audience. And then after that, if you could finish, I'm just curious, what would it take to make you quit? What would it make to make you quit an adventure like this or anything at all? What do you think it would take to make you go, okay, I'm done?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I don't give that a lot of thought, you know, ever. You know, I mentioned him earlier, you know, I used to climb with this guy, Steve. It was hard to tell, like, whether he was a mentor or a friend or father or brother. I mean, he meant a lot to me, you know, and he passed, you know, climbing accident, but he always used to tell me that he was the one that said you had to have a pure heart to do this stuff, you know, and he was right. But he would always, you know, he said to me one day, he's like, well, there's a huge difference between reasons and excuses. And that's become my crucible, you know. I mean, is it just uncomfortable, you know, because that's not a reason, you know. Am I scared? That's not a reason. Is it taking too long? That's not a reason, you know. So like, I just kind of apply that to whatever situation I'm in, you know. If I'm just like in some kind of like emotional agony, like I really just want to quit, because that happens, you know, like you, there's days you just want to quit, you know. But if there's not a reason for it, I won't quit. You know, that's, you know, a reason is a broken leg, or, you know, I mean, you'll know, you know, there's, you know, reasons are pretty blatant, you know, you know them when they happen.
And that was the program. Thank you very much for listening to West Coast Radio's interview with Carl Kruger. Once again, go to carlkrugerofficial.com or check out this episode's description or social media post regarding this episode for all the information regarding Carl Kruger and where you can check out all things Carl Kruger for yourself. That'll do it for right now. Very soon, next episode, in fact, is going to be West Coast Radio's 2-year anniversary show. So look forward to that. And in the meantime, good night.